Time to take a look at the wonderful world of our Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, emeritus wildlife ecologist from the University of Wisconsin and UW Extension. Always great to have Scott come by. I'm sure he'll talk a little bit about his trip to Alaska. He had his suspenders on today from the Red Dog Saloon in Juneau, Alaska. Looking pretty natty, if I do say so myself. Anyway, he'll talk about that, but we'll also talk about the bird loss. He has some more information, I think, that may be a little better served than some of the news articles we saw, which weren't necessarily fully correct, let's put it that way. Anyway, you may have a sighting, you may have a question about wildlife in your area, and I hope you'll call in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. It's a great place to send your photos as well. And today, Bucky Badger is 79 years old. And kind of in honor of that, Scott, we've got a heck of a picture from Vivian in Marinette. She sent just the other day a picture of a badger she saw. She had to explain to her Los Angeles friend that seeing a badger in nature is extremely rare.
It is, and that's a very nice picture. And yeah, she was lucky, and so was the visitor from Los Angeles. I've yet to see a live one in Wisconsin after all these years, but, you know, road-killed animals occasionally, which is unfortunate, but... over the years, we've had some really nice badger pictures sent in. So
that's a nice positive way to start. And
happy birthday, Bucky.
Happy birthday, Bucky Badger. Well, on the other hand, we've got a study that came out that shows a bird population decline of about 3 billion birds. And, Scott, you've looked more carefully into the research on this. Talk about it a little bit for us.
Well, it caught my attention when I saw the report in the local newspaper that just said, study, 3 billion fewer birds than 1970. I said, wow, that's interesting. I wonder how they figured that out. And they do, in the article that was in the local newspaper, they talk about the fact that the bird population in the United States and Canada was estimated back in 1970 at 10.1 billion. And now they figure, through the calculations they've done, that's been reduced to about 7.2 billion, which is a loss of 3 billion birds. And I have reasonable faith in the 7.2 billion because not in this article, but in the other one I found that was reported from the New York Times, they did a much better job of laying out the science behind it, which involved a lot of work with 143 civilian radar installations around the continent, which had been monitoring bird migrations for a long time, along with a lot of other data sets. And they also laid out that the architects behind this study were some very well-known ornithologists, including the director of the Cornell Lab and a couple other folks that were pretty well-known. That wasn't mentioned in this newspaper article as well. So 7.2 sounds pretty good. If you want to buy into the 10.1 with whatever techniques they were using in those days, there's clearly been a major decline. The other thing that bothered me a little bit was the conclusion in this newspaper article that the biggest loss, where does it say this now?
Sparrows.
They talk about modeling and trends in 529 species, but they credit a lot of the decline in this article to loss of house sparrows, English sparrows.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, wait a minute, these are an invasive species that we've been trying to get rid of for decades. Show me the problem. The other account, however, fingered red-winged blackbirds, same situation. They've been persecuted for many years, but went on to talk about the groups that are really imperiled, like grassland birds and a number of other species groups where popular birds like meadowlarks are way down, along with other species people are familiar with. And then in that what I thought was the better produced piece, they also said this isn't across the board. Some species like waterfowl, ducks and geese, for example, are close to all-time population highs. So wetland birds, where grassland birds, they're taking it pretty hard. Wetland birds doing pretty well. And that'll be a good segue into our discussion of the fact that it seems to rain a lot around here in a minute. But the bottom line was, yes, there are a lot fewer birds, maybe 3 billion, maybe some other number. But the way it was conveyed in the New York Times article, they factored in human population growth and took a number of different common species and said, okay, for every person in 1970, there were X number of meadowlarks. Today, there are only Y. Yeah. And it was a dramatic difference because there's less birds and more people. So the per capita number of birds is even less. So anyway, it's something to think about, not something that the average person is probably detecting. But, hey, that's a whole lot fewer birds to be at our feeders or in our backyards.
So. Absolutely. Brian in Dorchester has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Wondering the status on the whooping crane population. I saw a pair north of Marshfield yesterday. They appeared to be banded and quite tame. They were close to the roadway and just kind of oblivious to my close proximity.
Well, whether they're just so big and reasonably well defended with that beak or it's something else, I don't know. But there aren't very many whoopers around. But certainly over the last couple of months, I've seen, my wife keeps reporting it, there are sandhill cranes right along the edge of the road. And I mean, people get a really good look at them. And they seem completely undisturbed by people whizzing past or stopping to look at them. As far as the whoopers are concerned, there were some other reports of a pair people were seeing, maybe the same ones you saw. And if I remember correctly, and I've got my outdoor news here, we could check it. I think that the population, it's doing very well. The eastern population that they've been working on very hard to augment the few birds that were wintering down at the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge in Texas. And I want to say they've got something like 800 birds in the wild now, something like
I
that.
I think that's right.
Which relative to 10 or 7 billion birds is not a big chunk of the bird population. But as far as whoopers go, that's a lot. Maybe not quite enough to say that, hey, they're pretty secure, but they're doing the program has been a success.
There we go, Brian. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to mention the rain. I think if you there's hardly any place in Wisconsin today you could go where it hasn't rained or won't be raining soon. These and flash flood warnings in the state and tornado warnings. So how much effect this time of the year does this kind of rain have on our wildlife?
Well, the much like the crop situation, if it can be harvested, it's made or broken now. It's not growing anymore. It's just a matter of trying to get these things out of the fields. And I think it's similar with wildlife populations. The really damaging time for heavy rains and cold weather and so forth is in the spring, especially for nesting birds and reproduction in general. But that situation is pretty well over as well. So all in all, the rain, if it delays harvest, and it will, is going to mean a lot of crops are left in the field and vulnerable to everything from marauding flocks of redwings to
deer,
geese, deer, raccoons, squirrels, rabbits, etc. So if you couple the crops in the field for a long time, and maybe some of them don't get out at all, along with the jungle-like vegetation we've got this year. I mean, I've never seen my prairie denser or taller than it is this year. It's almost impenetrable. So there's lots of vegetation out there, which many things eat. There are lots of crops out there that are at some risk because of the the poor opportunity to harvest. So all in all, unless something happened to be caught in a flash flood, they're probably okay.
Yeah.
And some species, like the amphibians, for example.
Yeah, I love it.
Holy cow. This
well,
is...
your pond, at your about your own pond right at your own home.
So a few years ago, and we've talked about this on the radio before, I dug a little water garden and put a little waterfall in and a recirculating pump, and it's 10 feet long and 4 feet wide.
Very cool.
It's pretty cool. It's nice to have the water feature there. And I have had frogs occasionally over the years, and the toads breed in it, and occasionally peepers and chorus frogs. But this year I've been paying a little more attention because there's been croaking and squawking out there virtually nonstop since April. And last night I walked down, for example, and as I stopped to think about it and looked at what was sitting around on the rocks looking back at me, there were only a dozen species of frogs and a toad.
In Wisconsin, yeah.
And at this point, over the last couple months, I've had 7 of them in that little 40-square-foot
water garden.
7 of the 12. So we've had peepers, chorus frogs, tree frogs, green frogs, leopard frog, bullfrog, and toad. I think that's 7. I don't know where I live up on a hill. I'm nowhere near anything. Where did they come from? Especially the bullfrog. The leopard frogs travel around the country. I understand that one. And the tree frogs this year are just all over the place. I mean, every night we go out and do a frog check before we go to bed because outside the sodium light on the garage, they're lined up on the top of the garage door. And I think the record total is 22 of those bright green tree frogs sitting there waiting for a bug. So there are a couple of things. Number one, frogs seem to be doing very well. Number two, if that kind of thing, say, hey, that's pretty cool, then put in a little water garden. It's not a big deal. It doesn't have to be particularly expensive. You need a little shovel work and a good liner. You can get a good liner for under $100. Put a pump in if you want. And all of a sudden, you're off and running. And it attracts,
it's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun. It attracts a lot of things that want to drink. Not that water's in short supply right now. See, I hear them now in the background. Excellent.
Dave Potratz is at it again.
We leave the door open at night on the back deck, and this is the kind of thing we hear constantly all night long because that little pond is there. So it's a cool thing to do. It's really good for wildlife in general and obviously frogs and things like that in specific. So, not something you'd probably do this time of year, but put it on the spring bucket list for putting in a little pond, and I think you'd be pleasantly surprised.
I like that. Mary in Mineral Point has a question for you.
Hi. I sense that we have a bad connection, so I'm going to talk really fast and then take your comments off the air. We live outside Mineral Point on 55 acres of land, and since 2006, we've been doing prairie and savanna restoration. And I've been feeding birds year-round. And this fall, my safflower seed feeder and my Niger feeder, nobody's coming to it. They're eating at the peanuts, the woodpeckers, and some people are eating at the suet. But nobody's at the other two seed feeders. And so now I'm starting to worry about where those birds went. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Yeah. Well, she did mention that her prairie's been going really, really well.
There are a couple of things conspiring, Mary, and I don't know if you're still on or not, but you led me to believe from your comment that one of your seed feeders has safflower in it and the other one, Niger.
Yeah.
And while those are very attractive to some species, boy, I'd sure, given the cost of those two elements and the incredibly universal attraction of black oil sunflower seeds, I'd be feeding sunflower seeds if I were you. All I can say is I'm feeding nothing but sunflower seeds. And, this morning we looked out the window and there was a white-crowned sparrow on the deck. And I said, he must have just arrived, heading down on that north wind. And there were lots of other birds around, large numbers of mourning doves, finches. Some of the things that I had during the summer, like the rose-breasted grosbeak, couple pairs, they're gone. But the resident stuff at least in my case, pretty thick right now.
Well, and so, doesn't she just have a banquet, right? She's got 50 acres of...
Yeah, that's the other thing. You are living in the middle of essentially a giant smorgasbord. So I wouldn't be overly concerned by it. I would consider putting out just a simple shelf feeder with some sunflower seeds on it and see whether that makes any difference. But wait until some of this abundance of food that's in the environment right now begins to die back, be utilized, or get covered with snow, and I think you'll be right back in business. So nothing to worry about.
Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus professor from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Stephanie Hoff, our on-air producer today. Dave Potratz, our engineer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Focusing on the world of wildlife today here on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller with my guest Scott Craven. Great to have you listening in. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email questions and maybe a photo. If you got a wildlife photo, I'd love to see that too. Just go to ideas@wpr.org. Guy in Franco has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Guy.
Good morning. I have a question. I've been feeding my neighborhood crows here throughout the years, and I happened to notice this early summer that I seen some of the young ones, they were eating poisonous mushrooms. I was just curious, are crows immune to poisonous mushrooms?
Well, they could be. The reality of the situation is there are a lot of things in the environment that are toxic to different degrees. And various birds and mammals are differentially susceptible to some of these toxic compounds. So some animals can eat things freely with no ill effect that will either kill or dramatically sicken another animal. And generally speaking, they learn by experience or it's passed down. For example, a monarch butterfly that gets its toxicity from the glycoside, I think it is, in milkweed, birds learn either through a bad experience or, you know, mom talks it over with the guys in the nest, said, leave those pretty orange butterflies alone. They learn what to avoid and what not to avoid. Now, certainly they may make an occasional mistake and pay for it, perhaps with their lives, but generally speaking, if they do make a mistake, they get sick and they think, uh-oh, we're not going back to that food item again. So generally it works out all right, but I suspect, I don't know what mushrooms they were eating or about crows specifically, but my guess is they probably are able to eat those things with no noticeable ill effect.
Yeah, maybe a small amount, you know, maybe not their total meal for the day. So there you go, Guy. Thank you for calling. John from Somerset, Wisconsin, has beavers building a dam in his creek, and he tears it down, and they rebuild it every day. Well, we've heard that one before. He wants to know what's the best method for dealing with the beavers.
There are a couple of – well, I don't recommend pulling the dam apart every night and then having to worry about it again 24 hours later. They can be very persistent, and they're very quick. There are a couple of strategies. For one, there's quite a set of beaver-specific regulations about damage problems, dealing with dams and water control and so forth. The DNR has a separate little publication on that. I would try and find that online, and it will lay out all of your options. And that includes even potentially trap and removal, lethal control, however far you want to go with this. But that will tell you what you can do legally or who you can get to help you out. If you want to tolerate the dam and see what they do, there's also some technical solutions. I'm far enough out of the loop now that I don't know how much this is being used anymore, but there was and therefore still is a device referred to as the Clemson Beaver Pond Leveler. And what it is a piece of not huge diameter, but modest diameter culvert pipe or PVC pipe that is put in to the base of the dam. And then there's an intake upstream a few feet and then an outfall downstream below the water surface. And it keeps the water draining through. And I suppose it's eventually very frustrating to the beavers because they can't seem to figure out what the heck's going on here. The dam's still leaking, and it looks good to us. But nevertheless, that's been reasonably widely used in the past to solve the problem you're describing. But I would recommend that you just either go online to the DNR website and search under beaver management, or give your local wildlife manager in whatever county you're in a call and say, hey, do you have a copy of the beaver regulations, and see what options are available to you.
Noel emailed to ask if there could be cricket frogs in the Milwaukee area. He hears them calling, a distinct cadence, the sound of ball bearings kind of. What else could it be? He lives in an old neighborhood with lots of trees and marsh-like areas. He also thinks he hears copse frogs in his catalpa tree. Copse frogs. I'm not sure.
That's one of the two tree frogs.
Gray
tree frog and the other one. And they're distinguished by their song. The copse frog is a possibility. There are good tapes and things available on the internet to learn how to distinguish their calls.
Dave might find one for us. I don't know.
That issue can be solved through listening and saying, well, yes, I am hearing that, or I'm not. The cricket frogs are a little more tricky. Typically, they've been thought of as a southwestern Wisconsin species, and very rare, to be sure, a tiny little thing. But the ball-bearing sound is pretty distinctive as well. But I'm a little, especially in an old neighborhood, if you're hearing those from the trees, and this was mostly during warm weather, the problem with some of those frog calls is that they're very similar to some insect calls, some night-calling insects like snowy tree crickets and other things that Phil or the entomology people could tell us about. And I think there's a reasonable probability there. That's the tree frog, yeah. It's a little harsher and more nasally than the gray tree frog. But anyway, so you can probably sort that out on your own. But if you're really convinced you're hearing the cricket frogs, that's something I would report to the DNR in that area and let them have one of their herpetologists. They'd be interested in that
as
well.
They'd want to know, yeah.
Have somebody come out. And you're going to have to move quickly because we're talking, instead of 85 and humid, it's going to be 55 and not humid, and the frogs are going to clam up. So that opportunity may be lost for this year. But I think they'd still like to hear the report with the idea that, well, that's something we better go out and check out next spring.
Yeah, makes good sense. Dale in Wisconsin Dells, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
I'm in the Wisconsin Dells area, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
About 3 miles away from the house here, a farmer expanded his cornfield, which is quite large, and I believe there was a pair of eagles that I used to see flying overhead and then landing in that section of woods that he cleared out. And ever since he did that, I haven't seen the eagles anymore. And I was wondering if they would just pick another area in the same, another tree in the same area, or if they're going to move out because they were so disturbed.
Okay.
Well, that's a tough question to answer, Dale. Are you certain that they actually had a nest in that woodlot, or that they were just using it to roost or hang out or whatever? Did you ever actually see a nest?
No, because it wasn't at the edge of the woods.
Yeah.
But I parked there in the road and watched because I love eagles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And love having them fly over and scream. And so I would park on the side of the road and watch them, and they would both keep going there. And spend some time and then leave and then come back. And
okay.
Well, first of all, if we knew there was a nest in there for sure, then I think that's something that DNR would like to hear about. It's probably too late to prove anything or anything else, but you can't just knock down an eagle nest, some of which have been occupied for decades. So that's one problem. But if there was no nest and they were just hanging out there, they're probably still around somewhere, but they're far less interested in woods than they are in being able to get to the Wisconsin River or below the Dells Dam or wherever they're fishing, since that's their or scavenging along the roads. So they'll find another spot to hang out, and you just need to figure out where that is. This time of year, they're going to start, as it gets colder, a lot of them will start to move out, and you'll have to wait until next spring to see what happens. But I'm afraid if there was a nest in there and it's gone now and that's all been converted to crops, well, yeah, unfortunate, but probably nothing can be done at this point.
But it's illegal to do it.
Yeah, I can believe so.
Yeah,
I think there's a buffer zone around a known eagle nest that you kind of have to give them their space.
Yep.
But that's something that, Dale, if you're curious enough about it, run it past the DNR, either the wildlife manager or the conservation officer for that area. But as I say, even if it was there and it's now cleared ground, I mean, who knows? And and whoever was clearing the ground may not have known there's a dead tree or there's a bunch of sticks in that tree or whatever and didn't even see it or think about it. So it's hard to know what really went on here and whether there's any fault or whatever else, but I'd be patient, and I suspect they'll stay in the general area, but they may be leaving pretty soon anyway.
Yep. There you go, Dale. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. Bill in Madison, it's your turn.
Hey, so I'm watching these big vultures flying around, and I've never seen a nest. And I have no idea where and how they nest.
Where do vultures, or how do they nest, Scott?
Well, I guess I've never seen a vulture nest either, but that's because they tend to go to areas where they can nest on the ground, I believe. I think all their nests are on the ground, usually in rock formations and rocky hills, places like the Baraboo Hills, some of the rock outcroppings in the Driftless area, and that's where they hang out. And then once they've got young-fledged or they're not breeders, then you see them soaring around again. But I think most of their nesting is done in rather out-of-the-way, rough country where they nest on the ground. And if there are any vulture experts out there who want to add to that or correct my thin knowledge in this area, that's my impression. But we'll take a second opinion if we can get one.
Ginny from Lac des Flambeaux wants to know if the moose population is increasing in the state, wondering what it is in Vilas County. And on Facebook the other day, I had a friend had taken a picture of a young bull in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, and one of my neighbors, when I was up at the cabin in Price County last week, reported that a friend of his had seen a young bull in Price County. So there, as far as I know, Ginny, there is no population estimate for moose. There are a few wandering moose, particularly young bulls, that people do see in the northern counties, particularly in the northeast, where there's a good source population in the UP. I'm trying to think of when the first, for some reason I want to think it was 2002, but that was somewhere in there is the only or at least the most recent record of actually moose breeding in Wisconsin. But they're still a pretty scarce and unusual commodity and more of accidental than what we might call a population. And that's coupled with the fact that the only bright spot, one of the few bright spots in moose in general, is the burgeoning moose population on Isle Royal in Lake Superior. But other moose populations where they had strongholds in northern Minnesota, in northern New England, have suffered greatly in recent years. Major population declines attributed to parasite infestations like winter ticks and a few other problems. They still seem to be doing okay in the northern Rockies, but there have been some problems with moose management, but in Wisconsin, it's more of a moose is more of a curiosity than what you might consider a population.
Let's take another call. David in New Richmond, your turn. Hi, David.
How you doing?
Good. Appreciate your call.
On your turkey vulture nesting question, we've had a pair on our neighbor's property about, oh, maybe 100 yards from our place here for the last 5 years. And there is a wildlife photographer named Stan. It's Tequila. Everybody
right.
pronounces it.
Tequila, yeah.
Tequila, who has a book out. Yep. He was here to photograph them, and they have a nest in a broken off cottonwood tree about maybe 30 or 40 feet up in this dead cottonwood tree, and their nest is kind of where the hollowed out part would be at the very top of the tree.
Oh, interesting.
I'd give you the heads up on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, thanks, thanks, David.
Yep. Thanks.
So they're not all on the ground.
Nope.
That's for sure. Nathaniel in Campbellsport. On to you now. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi. I think when I was on the phone with the producer, the nesting of the vultures got covered. Did that fellow say they nest in cavities like hollow trees?
Yes, it was a dead. It was a broken off cottonwood with a big hollow at the top, and they were in that.
Okay, because the nest I had found was in the base of a totally hollowed out oak tree that was dead, and they were on the ground down in that hole. And then another friend of mine was tearing down an old outbuilding on a farm, and they were up on the floor of the old granary in there.
Ah, interesting.
Hmm. Well, so they're a little more adaptable, but they seem to be, it appears that they seem to want a solid footing. They're not up swaying in the branches of a tree. So whether it's the base of a dead tree, rock, old building, or something like that, seems like, we have firsthand evidence that they're using those spots.
Yeah. Thanks, Nathaniel. Did you have another question or comment about, cricket frogs?
Yeah, I'm not a herpetologist myself, but I work for one most summers doing some survey work on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And according to him, cricket frogs are extirpated. They were historically in southeast Wisconsin, but they're extirpated.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a lot of sound analysis. He's got these automatic recorders that we put out in wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
And I just recently heard my first cricket frogs ever doing that work because I sit at the computer and analyze the sound data. And it was up near the Twin Cities, and it's a really distinct sound. If you're used to listening to frogs, it jumped right out at me as,
right.
Oh, boy, I've got something different here.
So are you in agreement that the likelihood there's anything singing over in suburban Milwaukee is probably not likely?
I agree with that, and I agree with you, Scott, that if it was a cricket frog, he should definitely notify somebody because they would be thrilled.
Well,
clacking marbles sounds to me like a wood frog. I mean, he mentioned a ball-bearing type sound,
right.
And that's classic wood frog as well.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. And Dave's going to try and find cricket frog sounds for us, too, so he'll probably locate those and we'll be able to listen.
He's a magician with this equipment.
Here we go.
Okay,
here we go.
Yeah, it's really insect-like.
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
Which was the other reason I suggested it might have been an insect. But.
Yeah, that's cricket frog.
Okay, there you
All right. And Nathaniel, thanks a lot. Appreciate it very much. Good comments there, and it was great to be able to hear those cricket frogs as well. Susan in Madison emailed to ask what seeds to put in bird feeders that don't attract squirrels. We all heartily laughed.
Good luck. Good luck with that. Well, I think it's less the seed than it is the feeder. So there are various feeders that have anti-squirrel devices,
mm-hmm.
like counterbalance perches that will close a little valve kind of thing over mm-hmm. the hole if a squirrel gets on there.
I've got some of those.
Heavier than birds. Feeders can be suspended from wire cables and so forth so that, again, the squirrels have more difficulty getting to them. So it's more the way the seeds are put out than it is the seeds themselves. But having said that, the most popular seed for birds that we were talking about, a black oil sunflower, is also very, very popular to squirrels. They probably won't bother with Niger seed, the thistle seed. It's a tiny little black seed, but that's very specialized in terms of attracting finches, so you wouldn't want to use that alone. Safflower is very expensive, so you wouldn't want to be using that and have the squirrels at it either. I think that the issue of deterring squirrels, and I deal with it every day, the good news is right now I have no squirrel problems because, as we talked about earlier, the world is a smorgasbord.
Yeah.
There's a tremendous crop of horse chestnuts on my trees. There are acorns all over. There
Black
are walnuts,
walnuts
all over the ground. You know, a squirrel has to come down from a tree and look around, and they see a pile of food in any direction. They're not bothering with the feeders right now. So be prepared in the winter to put the feeders, you know, and if you go to a good bird feeding store where they have cones that you can put on the poles or baffles to put on a wire or other devices to deter squirrels, if you take those steps, then you can feed any seed you want.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, Anne emailed to, and she wonders what happens to amphibians in a pond. You were talking about your pond. What happens in the wintertime when the pond freezes?
An excellent question. And because that question has been posed to me this year because there are so many frogs.
Candy's after you to keep the
I think we've solved the problem thanks to the help of our close friends at Amazon. and we bought a pond heater.
Oh.
A floating pond heater, which will supposedly keep an opening in the ice and keep some oxygen in that water and keep it from freezing to the bottom. Now, having said that, I've not taken those steps in the past, and somehow, frogs are back. But the species that I have a lot of, like green frogs and so forth, overwinter as tadpoles. Sometimes takes a couple of years for those tadpoles, like bullfrogs and some green frogs, a couple of years for the tadpoles to overwinter. So I'm thinking that some are down there in the sludge and ooze on the bottom of the pond, and they're going to make it through anyway. So it can be a problem with freeze out, but somehow they either move back in, or species like the tree frogs and all that hibernate in upland sites, not in the pond, they make it through anyway, and then they're back breeding, and you have a new generation of frogs created right there in sight. So
there you go. Scott Craven, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Larry Mueller here. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Jane in Park and Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about bats.
Okay.
I've lived in my house for 20 years, and I had a bat in my basement a few weeks ago, and then it went away the next day, and I had a bat specialist come out, and just looking at my roof said I needed to spend lots of money to bat-proof my house. I'm just wondering if I should be concerned about bats in my house.
Well, Jane, I think that in general, everybody should be concerned about not only bats, but other animals that have the potential to get in your home. And we'll talk about that a little later in the program. But there's a couple of things going on. First of all, you've been in the house 20 years and not had a problem. And now you've seen one, maybe two bats. And we probably don't know what kind of a bat it was. So it's possible that it was an errant tree bat, like a red bat or some of the other species that don't necessarily occupy houses, in which case it's not indicative of a problem. The other thing to consider is that the colonial bats, like little browns, big browns, and so on, that normally are a homeowner problem, have been decimated by white nose syndrome. I mean decimated like 90%+ losses in some of our hibernacula. So places that where I work, for example, some of the university facilities up north and whatnot, where we could conduct a bat program and know there would be bats in this corner of the rafters or over in the boathouse or whatever, there are none. None. They're gone completely. So your concern is valid that no one would want an infestation in their home. But if you've not had a problem and looking around in the attic, you don't find accumulations of droppings or anything else that suggests that they've ever been in there, I guess at this point in history, I wouldn't be too worried about it, especially if you said it was going to be a costly proposition. What did the person say you needed to do to bat-proof your home?
He only looked at my roof. He never went into the home, and he just said he could see little places that need to be sealed up on the roof line, and then he'd put, like, one place where there would be the bat could get out but not come back in.
Yes, those are bat excluders. It's a little wire device that's like a one-way door. But those are only used to get the bats out, and then the structural repair has to be done behind it, so to speak, to solve the problem. So the techniques, but you said this was described as an expensive proposition?
Yes, very.
Well, the reality is that if open spaces, cracks, crevices, and so forth are visible, then I think it would just make good common sense to go ahead and do something to seal those up. But that doesn't take anything more than a few packages of steel wool shoved into those openings or this expandable foam insulation that you can buy in a spray can, and it fills up any crack and crevice. And I think someone could do that for you relatively easily. But to say that there are openings big enough that a bat excluder is necessary would suggest to me that you really need somebody to look around in the attic to see if there's any evidence that bats are in there to exclude.
Yeah.
And one bat is not a trend. It could be an accident. So I think you need to enter into this with a little caution and realize that this is a time in history when our bat populations are very depressed. So even people that once had them to worry about don't have them anymore. So
yeah, there you go.
Consider those things and do what you can do or a friend can do to seal up your home, which is just a good thing to do anyway. Yeah. And see what happens.
Good time to do it is go up in the daytime when it's bright out and keep the attic area dark, and then you can see where light comes in. And if you see light coming in, that may be a place where you are going to want to stick some steel wool or something in there to block it off. So there you go. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck. Ann in Arthur, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott. Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
Just fine.
Okay. Nice speaking with you. I have a question on milk snakes. We have two farms that are on the Iowa and Grant County line, pretty high up on the hill. In fact, one side drains to the Pecatonica and the other to the Platte. But now I'm starting to see milk snakes. I'm not sure if they live in the limestone walls that we have behind the house. But now I'm finding them dead, so I don't know if all this water is drowning them, or I'm kind of concerned about the babies dying.
Yeah. Well, the water could have an impact there, couldn't it, Scott?
Sure, although most snakes are pretty good swimmers if they have to be. But it's conceivable that they could have been trapped in a den or something like that. So I don't know about that part of it. The question posed on the screen here is why are there more milk snakes? And that's what I was thinking about a little bit. But, in a place like a farmstead where in a fractured limestone foundation there are plenty of good den sites, it wouldn't take but one successful or two successful reproductions of a female milk snake, and all of a sudden you'll have what appears to be lots of them around. That doesn't mean they'll all stay there over the long haul, but how many dead ones have you found?
I have found two, and they're intact, so nothing killed them. And then they were laying on the driveway.
And there's no evidence that they just got run over.
Right, they're intact.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, yeah, I guess intact is sort of a relative thing. In my case, our driveway has been sealed recently, so it's very dark. And as it starts to cool off, the northern brown snakes or Decay's snakes come from all over the prairie, and they're lying out there on that hot asphalt to get warm. And they get, unfortunately, they get killed in large numbers, and some of them don't necessarily, you know, show what happened to them, but we know what happened to them. So if they're out in the wide open spaces dead like that, I'd be a little concerned that they somehow got hit, clipped, squashed, or whatever, even though they may look pretty good. So yeah. I don't know what to tell you about the dead ones, but the fact that there's also all of a sudden a local population explosion, so to speak, could be accounted for by a couple of good reproductive events, much like all the frogs in my little pond.
Anne, thank you. Ruth in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn now. Thanks for calling, Ruth.
Thank you. I want to go back to the squirrels.
Okay.
I feed staff flower all summer long because the squirrels don't like it.
Excellent. That's my suspicion is that if push came to shove, do you feed? Do you have that same observation during the winter months?
They don't come up. They don't seem to come up, and I don't ever go back to. I will put some sunflower in it in a layer, but they don't. They don't bother my feeders at all. I watched them. I had three squirrels come up and check it out when I switched over, and every one of them sniffed and just kept right on walking.
Hmm.
Oh,
and well, excellent. Keep up the good work, and I hope it holds up for you. Sometimes with those kinds of things, it's not necessarily a matter of don't like it or won't eat it, but it's a matter of don't prefer it. So much like a deer walking through the garden, they'll take a few bites out of this and a few bites out of that and seemingly ignore something else. But when the circumstances change and food is scarcer than it is these days, that may change. But, hey, as long as it's working for you, keep up the good work, Ruth.
Thank you. Thanks very much for calling. Rick in La Crosse, it's your turn.
Yeah, the place where I work sells these suet cakes by the, I'm not kidding, by the semi-load.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing for the birds?
Well, the suet itself, assuming they're you know, good quality product and not, well, I don't know, I've not seen anything that I would say, oh boy, these shouldn't be used, but they're incredibly popular. And I would say I probably go through, I buy them in boxes of 10. I'm guessing I use somewhere between 8 and 10 boxes of them a year in two little wire feeders that hold the suet cakes. And they're really the only game in town for the woodpeckers. That's what they really like to work on. They'll take an occasional seed, but it's the suet feeders that bring in the woodpeckers. And I really like to see the pair of red-bellied woodpeckers that we have, the downies, the hairies, occasionally something else, but primarily those three. And they're there primarily because of the suet cakes. So the suet itself is a high energy. It's a fat. It's a high energy product
lard.
For those. It's lard, essentially, for those birds during the winter. And they take it readily. The fact that it's mixed with seed, I think the seeds are kind of bycatch as far as the birds are concerned, because trying to dig a seed out of a suet cake to shell the seed the way they'd grab a seed out of the feeder is a low-return proposition. But in addition to the woodpeckers, the red-winged blackbirds really worked over the suet this year. The blue jays seem to really like it. I've had titmice the last couple of weeks, and they've been working on it. So it is popular, and the fact that you're selling it by the semi-load suggests that other people have made the same observations. And you know, there's no evidence that I could point to or even suggest that it's detrimental to the birds, and it will attract species that you won't get otherwise. So
keep on selling.
On balance, keep selling those truckloads, and it's an important component of a feeding station.
Thank you, Rick. Dave in La Crosse, hello.
Hi. long time ago, I read an article about when people would cut trails into the woods, it would open the areas up to cowbirds, and they would move in on the deep woods birds and throw them out of the nests. And I was just wondering how big a factor that is, if that's been verified. I think it was done by some Illinois scientists.
Yes.
City.
Yeah.
It was a big deal and received a lot of publicity at the time, and it's still a pretty well-known fact as far as cowbird parasitism of songbird nests in a woods, for example. But I think the study suggested that the cowbirds could penetrate 50, 75 yards into the woods from an edge. So if you had a big block of woods, the cowbirds could get to the fringe, but that was all. Songbirds in the interior were safe. As you started to cut up this big woods with future roads for a housing development or, you know, trails to log or whatever, the cowbirds were able to penetrate further into the woods and affect more songbird nests. And nothing's really changed with that, although it just seems to have kind of fallen out of the public eye as the management concern that it was a few years ago. But it still goes on. I don't see many cowbirds anymore around my yard. Maybe no. They're part of the 3 billion that we've lost that we talked about earlier. But it's certainly a walking trail to get around your woods. That's not really what they're talking about. They're talking about something substantial that it might be vehicular access. That's where the problems come in.
And there you go, Dave. Thank you so much for calling. Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus professor from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. He'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. And so you have time to join in. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back right after this quick look at the news. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.
Learn, taste, and make at Fermentation Fest in Reedsburg, October 5th and 6th and 12th and 13th. From interactive art to sauerkraut, celebrate live culture in all its meanings. WPR is pleased to support food, the arts, and agriculture. Find out more at wpr.org/events.
Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, retired. He's an emeritus professor. Great to have him along, and certainly happy to have you calling in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. We have Alan Schrader from Rib Mountain said this wet year is the first year in 31 years his driveway is covered with spotted salamanders after a rain instead of worms or crawlers.
Well, I mean, no surprise. I've seen a couple tiger salamanders crossing the road, which is for this time of year when it should be relatively dry. Those animals are simply below the soil surface and you don't see them. But it's wet enough now so that any amphibian can go wherever they want.
Yeah.
Without having to worry about drying out. But part of this may be, depending on where he is, late summer, early fall is when the salamanders are leaving their breeding ponds to return to the woodlands where they spend the winter. And if they had it, especially if the spotted salamanders had an unusually good reproductive year, which they should have with all the water, all of a sudden there's a big wave of newly metamorphosed spotted salamanders heading back into the hills, so to speak, and that may be what he's seeing. But
he's
all this
the
is
mountain area, so there's plenty of woods there.
All this is enabled by the fact that it's so darn moist.
Yeah.
So,
Bruce in Waukesha, your turn now. Hi, Bruce.
Good afternoon, guys. I had a couple baby squirrels fall out of my ash tree, and I just wonder what would be the cause of that. They look healthy enough, but neither one of them made it through the night.
This was recent?
Yeah, like 3 weeks ago.
Oh, well, a late brood, but it does happen. As far as what happened to them, you know, if they were in a leaf nest, that could have been. We've had so many storms and wind events that may have had something to do with it, although I don't know what the weather conditions were the night they turned up. But there are also other things that might be molesting a squirrel nest, ranging from raccoons and who knows what else that may have roused a couple of them out, too.
Owl.
Possibly an owl or anything else active at night. So there's no telling, Bruce, but I thought where this was headed was I've got them in a box, and should I climb up there and put them back in the nest? But since they both failed to make it, I guess that really isn't the issue. But as far as how or why they got out there, whether it was weather or some potential predator or something else disturbing the nest, who knows?
Mom could have taken care of them if they were okay, because I've told this story, I think, of observing, spending a great fun afternoon watching a mother squirrel carry her young one at a time out of one tree nest, going over about 30 feet, climbing up another tree with them and putting them in their other nest. And they kind of clung underneath her body as she went down the tree. They were on her belly, and they had their arms up around her back and neck. It was fun to watch.
Well, that's another possibility, too, that comes to mind, is that something unfortunate befell Mom.
Yeah.
Car, whatever, during the day. And then as the young ones started to get pretty hungry or restless, and there's nobody there to oversee the situation, they made a move out of the nest that they might not have otherwise done and ended up on the ground.
Yeah, so that's another.
There are lots of possibilities, Bruce, yeah. But we'll never know for sure.
Yeah. Bob in West Bend, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, thank you. Yesterday I was out for a walk, and I found a stunned bird on the roadway, and it let me pick it up, and I was able to move it to a safe spot. But it was nondescript brown, a small bill, seed eater, but it was kind of a shade of yellow from under the throat to under the tail. What might that have been?
All the way under the belly?
Yep.
Yellow?
Wow. I thought we just had an abbreviated note here on the computer screen that said yellow bird. It's, oh, well, a goldfinch. But a yellow belly could – this was would you describe as a tiny bird, the size of a warbler, or a little bigger?
Yeah. No,
warbler.
Smaller.
Tiny. There are – boy, there are a number of them that have a yellow cast to the belly. And there are a number of flycatchers that the same, and they're also kind of a nondescript brownish or olive green on the back. I think if did you dispose of it, or you put it on the side where it presumably recovered?
I went back and checked later. I put it in a safe place off the road, but it was no longer there. Now, if it moved into the leaves, I wouldn't have been able to find it, or else it finally recovered and flew away.
Yeah. Well, that's common when they're stunned, so we'll hope it flew away and it's now part of the bird population. But I think your best bet, if you've got an image of it in your mind's eye, pick up a field guide to the birds and start with the warblers, then go to the flycatchers and just thumb through the color illustrations and see if something jumps
pops
out
up.
At you.
Yeah. Could be a number of things. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. We have John in Reedsburg next. Hi, John.
Hi. I've got a couple of questions about hummingbirds.
Mm-hmm.
One, our friends told us we're nuts to keep feeding the hummingbirds after Labor Day, but we have kept on, and they're still coming. Even though some of them look much different than the ones we did get earlier in the summer. In fact, I think they're a little larger in some cases. Yeah. Is that a different kind of hummingbird?
It shouldn't be. Hummingbirds are a good group of birds to try and become an expert on in Wisconsin, because we only have the one species. There are some oddballs that turn up occasionally, but basically we've got ruby-throated hummingbirds, period.
Yeah.
As far as the feeding is concerned, We're passengers in the same boat, because my feeders are still up and the hummingbirds are using them vigorously. In fact, I noticed with all this rain and the warm weather, the sugar solution had gotten a little milky. So I was about to say, when it's on my to-do list to make up a new batch tonight and refill the feeder one more time. But there are still flowers. We've not had a frost. There are still flowers out there. So I either see the hummingbirds on the feeder or on the window boxes at the petunias, geraniums, or what have you. So there's still a food supply. And you can stop feeding after Labor Day if you want. But if you enjoy seeing the hummingbirds, and I do, I'm still feeding. And I'm a strong believer that when we've had a frost and the flower source is gone and the day lengths are shorter and it's getting cold, those birds know that it's time. We're out of here, boys. And you're not going to keep them on your porch in the middle of a frozen wasteland with a bottle of sugar water. So you can suit yourself, John. But until we've had a frost, I keep the feeder out and enjoy the hummingbirds. So
there you go. Thank you for calling. And Dave in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I wanted to tell you about a problem I'm having or an issue I had with squirrels. I know you said that there's a lot of food around. I tried straw bale gardening this year, and so we have, I think, a half a dozen tomato plants, and for the last several weeks, the squirrels have been not letting our tomatoes get ripe. They just pick them and they'll eat them green.
Well, that seems kind of thoughtless on their part. I've got a lot of tomatoes and I've got a lot of squirrels, and fortunately, I've not had that particular problem. I have had chipmunks bothering. So you can see the squirrel sitting there, oh, look at this tomato, and chewing on it.
Yes, and actually I've gone to, I can get a couple of them to go. I get black walnuts, and I can get them to go in a live trap when then I take them out of town.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just amazing how many tomatoes, because we had real good luck early. The Straw Bale Gardens was real helpful to get the garden going early, so we were having tomatoes, and all of a sudden, about 3 weeks ago, we stopped getting ripe tomatoes, you see a lot of half-eaten tomatoes, because they'll eat part and then leave it,
yep.
And it's just amazing.
Well, I'm an avid gardener, so this would cause me great agitation if it were my situation. So I would do one of a couple of things. Since the tomato season is it's the 11th hour for tomatoes. So at this point, I'd be tempted to whatever you've got left in terms of decent sized green tomatoes. I'd be picking those and putting them down in the basement in some newspaper or whatever. And you can get those things to ripen and still have tomatoes, fresh tomatoes to eat at Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And they're going to be dead and ruined if we get a frost one of these nights. And we're not that far away from that. So that's one option. If you really want to try and protect them, I would at least pick the couple of best plants and try and cage them with chicken wire or something that the squirrels can't get through. Yeah. And that's the only way. You can try live trapping and removing squirrels, but
that isn't going to work.
It's an almost endless proposition, and it leads to great frustration. So either cage them and try and protect them that way. You might try a simple approach of sprinkling a few mothballs or moth flakes on the straw bales under the plants. That's a general repellent for most mammals. I don't know what it'll do to your squirrels, but it might be enough to send them elsewhere. But I'd also at least split the difference and pick some of the better specimens and put them away for future use.
Dave mentioned black walnuts, and there's not a black walnut tree anywhere close to my house, but there's a squirrel who finds the black walnuts and brings them over and comes up to my porch
And husks them right there.
Husks them right on the porch.
And that makes a big stain if you don't take care of it.
Yeah. It's amazing. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the call. And I don't know where he's getting those. I've got to do a better job of scouting out the black walnuts in my area, I guess. Gary and Merrill, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I got a problem. Not really a problem. I got a pond that's probably about an acre and a half, acre and three quarters, and I'm getting duckweed all over the pond and everything. And it's happened, off and on year after year, but now it seems that year after, now it seems to be on there all year round, and then I just depend on when to take it off to one side or the other. But I've heard, you know, differing stories about, is buckwheat good for a pond or is it not good for a pond? And I'd like to get your, you know, opinion on
duckweed.
Well, I mean, it is, as far as I know, it's a native plant, and it's easily spread from pond to pond by traveling
ducks or
wetland
whatever.
Birds, ducks or what have you. And it appears to me that once you have it, it's very hard to get rid of. I've got it in that little pond I was talking about earlier, full of frogs, and have had it in past years to the point where it creates a mat over the entire pond. And these are, if you look at them closely, they're tiny little floating plants, and they have roots that go down in the water. And if it gets really thick, that the roots kind of bind together, and you get this almost impenetrable mat. If it gets to that point, I think it's obscuring light that's getting into the pond that's generally good for other more beneficial aquatic plants and would probably be a bit detrimental. If it's a looser coating that moves around with the wind or opens up here and there, it probably isn't anything to get too concerned about. The tricky part is if you determine that it's a negative influence on the pond, I can't give you an answer on what to do about it. I've been trying to find that out for the last year and a half in terms of, you know, how to get rid of the stuff. Is there something you can add or spray or whatever, or some aquatic herbicide that might help? And the pond people and whatnot have been singularly unhelpful in resolving that. So in the case of my little pond, I made myself a screen on the end of a pole that I can essentially strain it out with, and I've done this year done a good job of keeping it at bay. You couldn't do that on an acre, obviously. I would be tempted to contact I'm trying to think, and I've not had much luck on this myself, but folks involved in wetland management amongst the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, Ducks Unlimited, or start with your DNR wildlife manager and see what you can find out. Because I think when it gets to the level you're describing or the level I had, I'd rather not see it like that.
Yeah, there you go. Phil and Lucy emailed from Plymouth, Wisconsin. They have quite a picture here asking what made these tracks, and there's a picture of the person's tennis shoes, and the tracks are bigger than the tennis shoes.
Much bigger. As we looked at it a few minutes ago, I've got to think that those are, you know, 5-6 inches long.
At least.
And that exceeds, you know, any kind of mammal.
Yeah.
So from the looks of them, with, you know, no visible pattern of a heel pad or anything like that, I think that those are probably overlapping tracks from a big bird like a sandhill crane or a great blue heron or something like that. So if that's, and I was going to say near water, but the cranes are way up in upland fields as well. So that's my best guess as far as that track, but it's not a mammal or something that
no.
might have expected.
Let's see. We will go next to Pew in Muscadet. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. See, now that it's bow season, I have some friends that have been in the Kickapoo Valley area, and they're reporting to me that they're finding lots of dead deer.
Do you have any sense of what lots means? Pew? I mean, are we talking about dozens, hundreds, you know, a couple here, a couple there?
They're talking like between 40 and 50.
Yeah. Well, that's the kind of thing when it happens quickly like that and in a concentrated area, it's usually epizootic hemorrhagic EHD, which is the disease that's spread by little gnats or black flies or no-see-ums or whatever. Those outbreaks tend to be localized. They've been reported in several places in Wisconsin. We're kind of on the northern edge of the impact of that disease, but it does happen, and it can kill quite a few deer in a relatively confined area because unlike something like chronic wasting disease, it might take a year and a half to kill a deer. I'm under the understanding that this can kill them in a matter of a week or two. and therefore they're all dead in a fairly confined space. Not good news for, you know, you ask what the impact is for bow hunters. Certainly not good news for that particular property or general area, but it's something that deer usually bounce back from relatively quickly in the future.
There you go. Thanks for calling. Connie in Portage, hi.
Hi, Larry. I heard you talking about the squirrels eating the tomatoes, and I wanted to tell you, I have never seen this. I have a dwarf apple tree, and in the wintertime, the squirrels come and take those apples. And I wondered if you'd ever heard of that.
Pick the apples off the tree in the wintertime, yeah?
Well, yes, I've heard of it a little bit. This is another thing that, like the squirrels eating the tomatoes, kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies because I've got apple trees and I've got squirrels. But, mercifully, I've not had that problem. But on the other hand, if you've got a – I guess my question is, why are the apples still on the tree in the wintertime? Do you not harvest them?
No, because I planted the tree for the animals.
Oh, well, then.
And I had a cherry tree I did the same thing for.
It sounds like everything's working out just perfectly then.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, well, you know, as what I think happens here is that come winter, what was a time of plenty for everything has changed dramatically, and food resources are becoming scarce or buried in snow and ice. And seeing those apples just sitting there mummifying, more than a squirrel could pass up. So they're working. I mean, there are a lot of things that would clean up those apples during the winter.
And thanks a lot for calling. We got a great image here, Scott. I don't know if you can see it on your screen, of turkey vultures. This is from Rhinelander. The old house they were in was deemed haunted because of the screeching. And here they are in the attic of that home. Kind of a cool picture.
That is a very cool picture, and that's kind of a cross between something cute and something really ugly, because these are youngsters, and the face and head is the really ugly part, but they're covered with white down, and they just look like a very unlikely creature. But there's more confirmation that their nesting habits are a little more diverse than what I led folks to believe earlier.
Jeff in Crawford County having a big badger problem on his farm. A USDA person came out and verified it was badgers. What can you do in that circumstance, Scott?
Well, the first thing I would have done is ask the USDA person, whose job it is to advise on these animal damage problems, if they confirmed it was badger.
They did.
But it seems like the next question out of somebody's mouth was, okay, what am I going to do about this? And generally speaking, I think this is a question they need to take up either back with the USDA Wildlife Services person or with the local wildlife manager to see what their legal options are. And then in some cases in the past, I've had people get some relief by working with a member of the Wisconsin Trappers Association who knows what they're doing and can remove the animals. But in terms of the legality and timing of all this, they should first run that by the wildlife manager or USDA person, and they may also have a copy of the directory of folks within WTA, the Trappers Association, willing to help out with these kinds of problems.
Yeah, rare. And hunting seasons are here. We got in the last 25 seconds or so, lots of seasons.
There's a big opening coming up in a couple of days with the youth deer hunt this Saturday and Sunday on the 5th and 6th. Hunters with Disabilities hunts the 5th through the 13th. The bear season closes on the 8th. The trout season closes on the 15th. And then the big opening, October 19th, for pheasants and grouse and zone B, quail, and a whole host of other things. And then the big deer season, of course, around Thanksgiving week. So there's lots going on in the outdoors.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. He will be back. We'll talk with him again on December 4th, actually. That's his next visit. Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist. October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and on the show we'll be talking about that with our regular consumer protection folks. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.